You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
So we were staying in OBS, and there was a director named David Moore who had an office in OBS. And his office was sort of a hub for broke, unemployed artists on a Friday afternoon. He'd make a massive pot of soup. What's the use running a soup kitchen for artists now that I think about it?
Hooray!
If you watched The Dan Nichols Show during its meandering 16 seasons on Supersport, somebody you would have seen almost as much as you saw me was the only other person to have been on every single one of the 16 seasons. And this is a combination of both his immense global popularity and the fact that he generally had nothing else to do and was more than happy to join me. Stuart Taylor, hello.
How's it, Dan?
I have fond memories of you in studio. I have even fonder memories of the collection of misadventures. And I'd often phone you up and say, Stuart, I'm doing something for the show. And there would be an audible sigh on the other end of the phone as you knew it was something either daft or life-threatening or both. But you felt this obligation through our friendship to come and help me out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm there for you, Dan. I'm always there. I know it's always going to come with lots of fun.
And it's for a long time, because something that not many people do know is that my entry into television was in part through you, and that in turn goes back to when we first met. And I remember this very clearly. There was an event at the University of Cape Town. It was raising money through RAG, the student charity, and I was the MC, and there was a host. And they bought this guy, I'd never heard of him, and he started doing magic tricks on stage. And then he told this collection of jokes about how he'd set fire to his jacket, and yes, first became a smoking jacket, yes, and then a blazer. And by the end of it, I thought, this guy's actually really funny. He's really good. I was really impressed. And that was my very first Stuart Taylor experience.
And it grew from there. Suddenly, I became a feature on your couch in your digs, and then we tried to crash all sorts of things. There was a Cricket World Cup over here where we pretended to be journalists.
We did,
and we went and crashed that. And there was a rugby event. We went and crashed that.
They were great formative years, because I think we were both trying to work out. We realized that we like to make people laugh.
Yes,
we like to try and avoid anything approaching a real job.
Correct.
But we did want to try and do something, at least make a little bit of money.
Exactly. We were the pioneers of the 4-day work week. In fact, we started off doing the 4-day work month.
I'm actually struggling to think if we could put together four in a month, let alone a week. There were a lot of project meetings about projects that didn't actually exist.
Yes. Which makes a work day. It does make a work day.
we had, not long ago, we had a good friend to us both, Joanne Strauss, on the podcast, and she was chatting about her background and the Miss South Africa journey and the platform she went through. She's gone Miss South Africa to sort of media superstar, personality, entrepreneur. You sit now as comedian, director, producer, entrepreneur on the basis of being a failed vet. What was it exactly you studied at Stellenbosch?
I've got a degree in physiology, zoology and animal physiology, to be precise, which, funny enough, I still I spoke about on stage 2 days ago. I was talking about experiments we were doing at Stellenbosch and how you mustn't let your personal bias get in the way, you know, and you've got to do the right thing. I can do serious talks as well, Dan.
So you went through that. Now, of all the time, you learned how to, I think one of your famous lines is how you learned to inseminate a pig.
Not quite a pig. It was a cow, actually.
Cow.
It was a cow. Yeah,
More impressive.
Far more impressive, yes. Pigs much harder to catch. Cows a lot bigger, so you can find everything inside a lot easier. That was extremely, I still have vivid memories of the first time I arrived.
Your first cow.
My first cow ever. Because, you know, you're doing it and it's a theory. You know, and you put your hand in over here and you grab down and you feel for this and you. I'm like, oh yeah, I mean, I'm never going to do this, but this is nice to know. Next week, we're in a van. 15 minutes later, we're on a farm. And the thing is this, that everyone else who was studying zoology, or I don't know if it was in zoology or actually it was in physiology. Everyone who was in the class was sort of like, their dads owned farms, which is why they were there studying this thing, you know, so they could take over the farm. My dad is a plumber guy. So I felt way out of place. And then we jumped, you know, we get out the van. Everyone just jumps out and they just go and grab a cow. And they're just there, enthusiastic. They, you know, do you know how big a cow is? Do you know how intimidating it is to, and they move, and it's sure, it's something else.
But surely you're playing some Barry White, lighting a candle.
That was what I was hoping for. That's what I was hoping for. It was a lot less romantic than that.
I'm sure the cow remembers it fondly.
Sadly, probably not. I did get a lot better as I went on. I did get a lot better.
The romance story I really love, though, about your time out at Stellenbosch before you moved into global fame and stardom was your wife, who I love and adore. She's about 3 foot tall and absolutely terrifying.
Yes.
And she decided you were the man for her, despite the fact you took her on what was probably the single worst first date I've ever heard of.
I don't think it's a... You know what it is? You start with low expectations, Dan.
Oh, you couldn't have started with lower, Stuart.
You got to look at the context. It's 1997. McDonald's is still a big thing. It had just moved into the country. My wife is from the Platteland. They did not have a McDonald's. So when she saw the glow of those golden arches as we walked towards it, because, you know, there were no cars, we had to walk there. It was, you know, I could see she was, you know, face lit up under the neon lights. She wasn't as impressed when I didn't offer to pay for her.
You made her go 50-50.
Yes, not even 50-50. I was like, baby, whatever you're having, you're paying for, man. It's...
And yet somehow she stuck with you.
Somehow. Yes. No. That's it was I think it wasn't like a proper first date. It was like a friendly first date. Like there were other people. But you remember it as the first date.
Yeah, she has no recollection of that. She just remembers somebody from her friend zone refusing to buy her dinner.
Yes.
What was your parents' reaction? They'd obviously put a lot of time and effort into helping you get to university. You were studying this impressive sounding degree, even if it was making you doing strange things with cows on a Friday night. And now, actually, you know what? I'm going to be a magician and a comedian. That's kind of most parents' nightmare.
It is most parents' nightmare, but there's a preamble to this. So the comedy starts way before varsity. So I went to a place called the College of Magic when I was a kid, and that's where the magic tricks happened. And I was doing kids' birthday parties while I was at varsity, and then that became, okay, I'm going to do some close-up magic for my friends over here, and that's a way to talk to girls. And then that became, okay, well, I can go to a bar, and there were like comedy nights that was happening. So I was at university in my final year when the Cape Comedy Collective started, and we were actually doing gigs. Like I would drive from Stellenbosch to Cape Town almost twice, three times a week, and come and do shows here. So there was an actual sort of infrastructure that was starting to develop. So that was the one side. I did, however, think, so this is the path. I get kind of to my last year of varsity and I go, this is really not going where I thought it was going to go. I mean, it's lovely. I find science extremely fascinating, but I can't really see this being like a thing. I also like nice things. So I decide I'm going to apply to do the accounting conversion course at UCT.
Just to make it more exciting.
This was my plan. I thought, so I read about this thing. I had a friend, actually, a girlfriend from youth. She was, and her dad was an accounting lecturer, and her brother had done this. So her brother was an engineer and then decided to do this accounting conversion course. I'm going to explain it. And she goes, well, basically, you do a BCom first, second, and third year in 1 year. And you can only do it if you've got a degree, because you understand the demands and you get classes 6 days a week, you get tutorials on a Sunday, and you go to every single lecture. And so you're at varsity from 7 in the morning till 9 at night. You give up a year of your life, but you walk out with a BCom degree, number one. Number two, you're probably one of the most sought-after people with a BCom degree, because now you've got a background in something else. So, for example, I go, man, I know how farms work. You know, suddenly I can go and be an accountant for a bunch of farmers, because they're going, oh, you know, my bull semen was expired. And I'm like, yeah, don't worry. I get it. I understand. So you get to be a very creative accountant, I guess.
And we do have a lot of those in South Africa.
We do. So cool. I'd been earning enough money doing these kids' birthday parties and all sorts of things. So boom, put down my money and I apply to do the accounting conversion course, and I go and write an aptitude test. Bang, and I get accepted and I'm going to start varsity.
Stuart Taylor, the accountant.
The accountant.
I'm struggling to picture this.
I promise, 3rd or 4th of Jan. Like, you're going to start early in Jan because you're going to do every single BCom class. And I'm sitting on my bed, sort of the day before orientation. I'm ready to go. It's 8 in the morning. And my mom walks in to my bedroom and she says, "Do you really want to be stuck in an office your whole life?" And I never went.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not, normally it's the other way around, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. So, and for her, because she was like, "You love this thing, this, you've got the performing thing is a thing, but you just love the science thing." Like, I mean, I would be gushing about, oh, you know, we were out at the beach and we could go to a place and I could tell you, I could wax lyrical about every single shell you were seeing, and this was this and this is from this era, and, you know, or we'd go to, I remember I was walking with them at the Two Oceans Aquarium and I sounded like a guide because I knew every single crustacean and every this and every that and, you know, could talk about whatever. And that was kind of the thing I loved. And she was like, "Why would you, just for a paycheck? And, you know, go do the thing you like doing." And then I thought, okay, cool. Well, here's the plan, you know. I still, the magic, the comedy, it's a fun thing on the side. Here's what I'm going to do. There's a degree called MPhil. So it's a master's in animal physiology. It's a 2-year structured course, which I could apply for. And it's 3 months on, 3 months off, 3 months on, 3 months off. Over 2 years, at the end of it, you get an MPhil. So I could still perform for 3 months and then come and study for 3 months. And this is going to be great. I'm basically like a 2-year sort of gap year. I'll have my master's at by the time I'm like freaking 23 years old. Then I'll immediate freaking straight into becoming a junior lecturer. Get my PhD by the time I'm 28. Head of the department by the time I'm 30. Dean of the faculty by the time I'm 45. This is going to be amazing. And lecturing is kind of like performing. Cool. I'm in for it. So this was in the back of my mind, and at this point, we're still performing. You know, it's at seating. So I'd now missed. I figured, well, I'm not going to register now. I'll do it next year. I'll do a gap year where I just do this comedy thing and see where it goes. And so I was spending a lot of time in OBS with Kurt. Kurt Skundrat was staying in OBS. He had a couple of very cool roommates that I got along with very well, and I spent lots of my time over there. It was gigs, and it was fun. It was great. I lived in a separate entrance at my parents' house. Life was amazing. So round about August rolls around. I drive to Stellenbosch. Liska's still at Stellenbosch. She's busy with her masters. And I drive to Stellenbosch, and I'm like, I'm going to go register. I'm going back to varsity. And I get to the physiology department. "Yo, man, prof, how's it going? I want to register for the MPhil." And he goes, "Well, it started this year and it runs every second year. So you can't start next year. You're going to have to wait another year. So the drive home, and I'd been getting a lot of pressure from the guys at the Cape Comedy Collective going, "Stu, you got to move out of your parents' separate entrance, my guy. You got to actually stand on your own 2 feet." I'm like, "I'm standing on my own 2 feet. I come and go as you please. It's amazing.
I buy the washing powder that my mum uses to clean my clothes."
I didn't even, but she did always ensure there was a cool drink in the fridge at the back for me. You go shop in your parents' cupboard and then you come to the back. And Kurt's roommates were moving out. So he needed to find a new roommate. And I was like, you know, all the stars sort of align and you're like, okay. So I thought my parents were going to freak out by the fact that I'm going to move out. So I was like, "Listen, guys, I think it's time for me to move out." This in a colored community, this is an unheard of thing. My boy, you've just barely turned 22. Why would you want to move out? So I tell them that, and, you know, they're very calm about it. And I go back to the separate entrance eventually, you know. And there's a property paper my dad had put on the pillow. Property section. It's like, "Go ahead, boy. We cannot wait." And I was like, "No, listen, anyway, this Kurt's roommate is moving out, and I could probably move in there." And that was that. That was the end. And I was like, okay, I'm going to lean into it. It means it gives me another year. I will absolutely lean into that. I'm going to be a performer. And there were all sorts of things. You know, if you read Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers, mm-hmm. he talks about, you know, right place at the right time. If you read the registry of the basketball teams, everyone is born in January. That happened for South African comedy. If you name all of the comics of our generation, my generation, be it a David Cowell, Joey Dustin, anyone who kind of started at that point, about 95%, Riyad Musa, Kagiso Diga, Tshepo Mogale, I can go on and on and on, Chris Forrest, we were all born in 1977 or 1978.
It was a rich seam of comedy magic.
It was, but also what it meant was that around about 1999, 2000, we were all just finishing varsity but hadn't started families. No one had settled down. No one was quite ready to... You could go and crash on someone's couch. You were young enough to crash on someone's couch. You were young enough to go, I'm just driving to this next city and I don't know what's going to happen. But you were established enough that you had the ability to do that. Along with the advent of Kalula.com, you could fly to Joburg for $400 and gigs there were paying $600.
200 rand cold profits.
Do you know what I mean? So it was literally, we were doing that. You'd go and you'd go, Conrad Koch, yo, guy, I'm at the airport. Come and fetch me. And likewise, when they came to Cape Town, yo, I'm at the airport. Come and fetch me. I need a couch to crash on. And that's what that entire comedy scene became. And we leaned into it. And that was like 20 odd years ago now.
It was a lot of stars aligned because at that time, there were so many people like yourself who had natural comedy ability, but also had all of these added elements that you just mentioned. And it was probably the golden era of South African comedy.
Absolutely. And then there was, I think these things come in waves because funny enough, the next batch, if you mention comics who are not born in 77, 78, most of them are born, because I see the IDs because we now book the flights. There's like, there's a whole crop of 87 babies. Like the Mojack Leohos or the Ebenezer Dibakwanis, the Mpo Pops. In fact, I think Pops and Mojack were in the same class. There's like the whole new crop were all born in the same year. And I don't know, it's interesting in terms of whatever happens in the politics, whatever happens in the zeitgeist that kind of allows for all of the stars to align. So I'm acutely aware that, you turn a different corner and you live a completely different life. It's like, how lucky that, those things worked out.
So, I mean, this could have been a far less interesting conversation about the impact of updated Excel spreadsheets on the life of agricultural accountants.
Yes.
I'm very glad that it's not. And it says you're off on this path, ours intertwined from there on in. But you also went off on a number of adventures. And the one that also really inspired the kind of stuff I love to do was your voyage around South Africa. This challenge to take on South Africa in a car that looked almost as broken down as one or two of your co-hosts, as you took on the beauty of backwater South Africa and only going nowhere slowly.
Yeah. So I remember we were staying in OBS and there was a director named David Moore who had an office in OBS. And his office was sort of a hub for broke, unemployed artists on a Friday afternoon. He'd make a massive pot of soup. He was running a soup kitchen for artists, now that I think about it. But he loved to cook. So he'd cook a big pot of soup and he'd bake some bread and we'd all just hang out. And he was friends with all of the comics and lots of actors and so on and so forth. And many people would hang out over there. And he became very good friends with Kurt. The love of cars, I think, set him and Kurt off. And he pitched this idea to the SABC and he tells this story. He says the company was on their last legs. They were done. He had worked in F&B and he'd started this company and he was like, okay, it's done. We gave it a good swing. It's just fallen apart. And he says to his sister, like, I've got $50 left. I'm just going to play it on the lotto. So he opens his laptop to go into the UK lotto to play the $50. And Friday afternoon, boom, the mail comes in from SABC. Listen, that show you pitched like 10 years ago, do you still want to do it? Here's the money.
So not the lotto win he was expecting.
Not the lotto win, but right up to the edge. And then, boom, he found the people. And initially, Kurt Schoenraad was in it with Anton Visser and Dave Levinson. Actually, the three of them started this journey. Dave, you could not find two more different people. There was going to be a clash before they hit the tunnel. Before they hit the Huguenot tunnel, things had already fallen apart for those two. They are so similar. So needless to say, somewhere in the Karoo, Dave Levinson got dropped off. But still, like Dave set the tone. What is what I don't think, like... credit where credit is due, I only knew what to do on that show because once it aired, I got involved and I watched Dave Levinson be a very natural presenter. And I was like, oh, this is what the show is supposed to be. You're just supposed to say things to the camera about what you're seeing, what you're experiencing. And the line was, David Coy would say, was, Stu, Coy has a link. And that meant say something about whatever it might be. And you can. And for me, I didn't realize it was supposed to be factual. So I would just make up lots of things.
The seaside town of Bloemfontein.
Exactly, exactly. I'd get to a monument and I'd start talking about, you know, there's a monument to whatever. It's, you know, it was for the war on drugs. They had put this up in 1742. You know, there's a big.
Which was a very bad time for heroin in exactly. The outskirts of Kimberley.
Exactly. And I just thought it was being amusing. And then we did get one or two BCCSA complaints. But that's not factually correct.
Hey, didn't traffic cocaine in Pietermaritzburg in the 1700s?
It's always someone from Maritzburg. So what had happened was I was doing a show at the Roxy Review Bar, actually. And one of the – Dave sent a camera crew down to film the show. And he's going, because we didn't know each other that well. So he just wanted to kind of get the sense of the vibe. And he's like, Stu, listen, cool, love what you do over there. Because the idea was that it was supposed to be a couple of comics on the road. And wherever they stop, they do a show or two. That was the initial pitch to the SABC. So they go, okay, cool. Your story is we find you in Namibia. You are at the hotel in Namibia and you're doing a show. And we say to you, do you want to jump in the car? And so I ended up doing the second half, but just just more than half of the first season. And what had happened was by the end of the first season, I started narrating it as well. And Anton was getting ready to step out. He was wanting to move into a space as a director. And so he had other things he wanted to take on. And then by season two, it became, oh, Stu, you're doing this thing. And then it was many, many seasons of driving around in a broken down car and getting stuck in many, many little dorpies. But it was an interesting time in South Africa's history in that the entire country really felt alive with possibility. I'd love to retrace our steps now and just kind of see how things have changed. I think things have improved or not improved or fallen apart. And some, I think the landscape has changed. And it also taught me how to travel in a very different way. I was a sort of destination kind of person. Get in your car, gun it, stop at a Wimpy, grab a coffee and go. Whereas this thing was about, no. We're going to be there in 2 days' time. The journey is the thing. And I still do that with my family very often. In fact, now...
to their annoyance. It takes them 4 hours to get to the beach.
Absolutely to their annoyance. So the great thing of I'm going to go to Makanda and do a show. And Eliska's like, oh, well, I'm not coming to Makanda. I'll meet you at the airport in Kabeja. And that's it. So she'll fly down with the boys. And then we're in the car and it's a meander home. And we don't know... I know that school starts in 10 days' time, so I've got to be home in 9 days' time. But the joy of just sort of meandering along the garden route and, you know, you stop over here and you can call ahead. And, okay, cool, in 3 days' time. I know this place is very busy, so I'm going to book it in 3 days' time. But you take your time getting there.
So give me a couple of places then, in as much as the memory allows, that you would send me along to, not necessarily because they are the Paris or New York or Niagara Falls of, but just places that you remember having a warmth, a charm and a surprise factor to them. Somewhere you went and you thought, gee, I didn't even know this place existed.
I used to say, so this is also, I haven't been to a lot of these places in a long time, so I can't.
None of them exist anymore.
They might have all fallen apart, but at that point in time, the most surprising one. So I learned to love the Karoo. Firstly, I learned to love the Karoo. The Tankwa Karoo is beautiful. The Great Karoo is amazing. The Little Karoo is incredible. I do love the Karoo now because I don't think there's any other place on earth that's got that kind of landscape. But Upington. Upington, people would say, what are your favorite two towns? Upington was number one because you expect it to be dry and arid, but it's on the Orange River. So it's this contrast of landscapes. It's an extremely green. I mean, there's wine farms out of Upington. And also just weird, quirky things. The roads in Upington are incredible outside of Upington because Upington's airport is the alternative landing site for the space shuttle.
Ah, yes, that's true. Yeah,
so it's got one of the longest runways. I think they're probably the longest runway in the Southern Hemisphere. You have massive, massive cargo planes landing over there with supercars because they test all the supercars on the roads in Upington. So you'll be driving and just suddenly a Bugatti will come speeding past you. So the roads are immaculate.
Which then gets overtaken by a minibus taxi heading up to Johannesburg.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is a thing of beauty when you're like, oh, so there are no speed cameras here. Let's go. Although that was in like a 62 Chevy, so it was like, cool, I'm gunning it at 80 kilometers an hour with everything rattling. So Upington was a real surprise for me. But the other one, which is warm and charming, is Mossel Bay. I like Mossel Bay, although anything along our garden route. The garden route is so beautiful. As soon as you, I mean, yeah, it's just all, it's all spectacular and it's all like, I always say to people, you don't need to travel very far. You just need to drive a couple of hours and you'll see a changed landscape and it's, you know, you experience a whole new version of your country.
Yeah, it is. We often get seduced by the rest of the world looks so glamorous, and South Africa does have much to it. I'm glad we spoke about that. I also wanted to chat to you about a shared space that we have, and it's one that comes up regularly. How you haven't been hauled off by the Child Protection Services yet, I'm not sure, because the caliber of the jokes that you inflict upon your poor boys in your regular social media dad joke space, which is an offshoot of what I genuinely sense is your greatest joy, and that is having become a dad and having two incredible boys who, like all kids, drive their parents mad on a regular basis. But Stuart the father, I think, is Stuart's favorite iteration. Would that be right?
I think so. Listen, it's certainly I learn more from my boys than I think I've learnt in any aspect of my life. Like, they will teach you many, many life lessons if you are just open to those life lessons. I'm at a point now where things, the balance of power is shifting. My youngest can beat me so badly at table tennis right now.
And he's 3. How old is he now?
He's 13.
That's crazy.
So he's just started high school. He's just kind of chest a little bit, you know, puffed out a bit. And he's got some serious skills. He can find, you know, a slammer or smash a table tennis ball. So those, it's an interesting space where you go, geez, okay, so I can't, I'm not the guru over there anymore.
Part and, pride, part you annoying little bastard.
Yes, exactly. I just give you way more maths homework, depending on how much, by how much you beat me. So as I say, there's this balance that shifts where suddenly they know slightly more about certain things than what you do. And the ability to swallow your pride and apologize and say, oh, that's interesting, and then to meet them where they are is like, that's the real growing where you're like, oh man, okay, cool. We, you know, I don't know it all. You can teach me some things. It's fantastic.
It's a very quick transition as well. My kids are a little bit younger than yours, but you see, I'll go away for a couple of weeks and I'll come back and something dramatic has changed. And
completely.
It's both, part of it's quite rewarding as a parent, but part of it's genuinely unsettling, partly because you think, oh my God, I'm getting old because they're big.
And also you realize that your time with them is so fleeting. Yeah. So as much as we relish the fact that we can go out for dinners now without any babysitters, you know, the eldest is 16. I'm like, dude, it's funny. My niece, who is 14, did reach out to me. Said, Uncle Stu, if you need anyone to babysit the boys, I'm looking to make extra pocket money. Do you mind? Her mom was like, you know, David is older than you. She's like, I know, but I'm just saying.
I'm very mature.
If they need anyone to babysit, I'm available. I was like, sure, Ash, I will. If the puppy needs babysitting, we'll call you. But you do realize that, like, we don't have a long time left with them. We were talking about holidays. You're like, jeez, I mean, we've got a couple of summers left, and then they are not going to want to go with you, which is fantastic if you're flying overseas.
But not quite so when you realize that suddenly you're not the coolest people in the world anymore.
Yes.
And
no,
there's an age in which your kids still just adore you and you are the role models, and then absolutely, they start to discover one or two of those flaws.
That's exactly it. But I think it's about leaning into it and just like enjoying the time being a parent. I think that's the that's the biggest challenge, is to don't get bogged down by the admin of this thing. Like this, you'll get sucked into maths homework and now you're scolding because they don't know how to solve X. No, rather spend your time enjoying them where they are, meeting them where they are.
Well, I know your boys, and you've done a terrific job as a dad, and you'd be very proud of that. And very proud of not having strangled them, given that one of your friends, I say loosely, because I don't think they really could be friends, gave the boys a drum kit as a Christmas present one year.
This was Andy's godmother's. Andy's godmother's like, here you go. Here's a drum set, Andy. Which thankfully... he didn't take too much. Well, he couldn't because we sold it on Gumtree. He came in one day and said, where's my drum set? I'm like, ah, oh, it's gone, bro. You weren't using it. So, you know, it's just gathering dust.
But I only got it yesterday. Oh, so Stuart the parent. What about Stuart the husband? Because I feel I definitely need some counsel here in the art of navigating this job of, it's not trying not to do anything wrong. It's working out what you can do that's least wrong.
Yes.
And then finding the best possible way to minimize the fallout.
I think we've, you know, you were at the wedding, Dan.
I was indeed.
You were at the wedding. Do you know how many years ago that wedding was? And it's coming up on the 4th of September.
This is going to both impress and depress me at the same time. Well, we can kind of work this out because we've known each other now for 22, 23 years. It wasn't that long. It must be the better part of 20 years now.
20 years? It'll be 20 this year. Yeah.
But Eliska wasn't legal to get married in that case.
Thank you, Dan. Get me the brownie points. So I think we've learnt to argue well. We've learnt to fight well, because there are going to be fights in relationships, and so we've learnt to take it, deal with it, have a blowout, and then move on very swiftly. I think that is probably the greatest maturity in our marriage, is that we'll go, I don't know, what, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, cool. Tea? Can I have a tea? Yes, please. That we just don't carry it through. We just understand that some person is going to, there are going to be moments where you're going to overreact to some things. You don't take it personally, you don't take it on, and you can have a massive argument about something, and it actually doesn't matter at the end of the day. It's, you know, these things are they're fine. They're all so insignificant. Everything is so insignificant. It's just
Now, you see, I don't have to worry about these sorts of things because I got married to a Greek lawyer. So I just win every argument at home. It's just an absolute walk in the park.
That's, yes, well done.
I think my greatest triumph is that I do not have Le Creuset imprints on parts of me as dishes go. No, but I have to say, my wife has never thrown anything at me. She doesn't need to. She just looks at me and then I apologize and go and wash the dishes.
Right. No, I'm sure she has thrown things at me at least once or twice. I'm pretty sure. No, I think we've just come to a point where we just go, you know, we don't pit the sweaty things. We don't sweat the pretty things.
Oh, does it get more Freudian than that, Stuart Taylor?
Don't sweat the petty things. And it's all petty. It's all petty at the end of the day. So I think we've learned to argue well. And just, which means...
And that's quite a skill set.
It is. And it's only taken 20 years. I mean, I literally think we've only gotten there in the last year or two, maybe.
All right. Well, look, I think the next 20 years, you'll kind of hit your stride.
We will hit our stride.
And then you're kind of at the halfway mark. And then you just...
Exactly.
Take off from there.
And it's interesting because we work together. This was I was telling you about a talk I was doing where a conflict of interest is relationships in the workplace. And I was like, well, I can speak about this. And I think that's where the sort of maturity comes from, is that we realize that we're working towards a goal. We're on the same path. So we work towards this end goal over here, which means that you can't... because work never stops for us. We could be working on something at 8 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night or 8 o'clock in the morning. Work never stops. We're always just working, or we're always having good times. So don't take the negativity or the vibes from you're my business partner now. I need my business partner as opposed to my wife. My wife arrived. Like, I need that person to be the same person who's just kind of cool, and vice versa.
And you've got skill sets that complement each other brilliantly. She's incredibly organized. She gets things done. She's on time. You are none of the above.
But
you are, and you have been for a long time, and I say this from Dan the fan as opposed to Dan the friend, and you are one of my favorite comedians.
Oh.
And it's not just the fact that you are genuinely very funny, but you have mastered something that I don't think a lot of slaffering comedians always get right. There certainly are some, but not all, where you're very good at picking up on the nuance of this country of ours, but not ramming it down people's throats, not taking the nice, simple, low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
But you have a lot of fun along with making people laugh. I've been to a number of your shows where at some point there's a slightly uncomfortable silence because you've said very knowingly something that you know hits a point in South Africa where we're not comfortable. And I think a lot of great comedians have that ability to be social commentators, but in a way that lures you in with laughs. And then, I wasn't supposed to be thinking about stuff in this show. I just wanted to laugh. And now he's making me contemplate my awareness and who I am.
Well, I mean, I think it's... Yeah.
I tell you what, one of my favorite lines is when you sum up, because you used to be a nice blue collar down to earth sort in Ottery, then you upscale to this mansion in Constantia where you now sort of have Elevenses and butlers. And I've tried to go to your house, they wouldn't let me in.
No.
But you
those
talk
are not
about.
Butlers. Those are my kids.
Earning a living. They've got a side entrance.
they do.
I remember talking about how Constantia is the kind of place where you walk along and you step over a homeless person to pick up a lost puppy and make sure it gets home. And it is such a simple and yet brilliantly accurate portrayal of what could be an upmarket suburb in many parts of the world, but it just has that extra layer because it's South Africa.
I think South African comics are tempered slightly differently. I think we do tend to have a bit of an edge to what we talk about, and we can push it a little bit further without, and I think it's sometimes unintentional. I think it's just how we are tempered. It's the world that we live in, you know, we and it's not necessarily, I think we've just got a bit of an edge, as opposed to if you have a comic from the UK or Australia, they are not tempered in the same space. They don't have the same nuance around them. They don't see it as clearly as we do.
Which you see, because as well as making people laugh, you bring in other people who make people laugh.
Yes.
And you run big comedy festivals. And without mentioning any particular names, there are some very well-known comedians who have come into South Africa and haven't spent the time learning a little bit about this space and think, right, well, you know, I'm big in America, man. I'll be fine here.
Yes,
they're not, because this is very different.
Completely, completely. I mean, we had one very recently where we brought a big international star, and he was like, "I'm in Africa, the motherland." And Joburg goes crazy. Yeah. And then his opening line was, "So Biden." I'm like, "Biden, okay." And then this was really weird. He just started doing his club gig, and then a minute in, he was like, "You know, because we don't like the gays here in Africa." They were like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 guy, this is not Uganda." An entire audience just like, "Where does this guy think he is?" So, I think an awareness of the world around you, I think that goes a long way. One of my favorite comics on social media right now is Andrew Schultz. Andrew Schultz pops up on my social media feed all the time, and he's an anomaly as an American comic because he's so aware of the world around him. So he goes and he just does gags about the world. I mean, I was watching him do this, a snippet of him doing a show in Abu Dhabi, talking about the library, and then be like, and he looks at the ladies like, "One day you'll be able to read those books." In Abu Dhabi. And he gets away with it. And it's because he's become a student of the world, and he loves the cultural differences and the cultural nuances. And I think I kind of spotted that early on, you know, back in the day. There used to be the South African, whatever it was, Cape Town International Comedy Festival back in the day. And a UK comic would come over and he would just point out our differences. if you just go, oh, you call it robots. Oh, my goodness, you call it robots. It's so weird. We go, oh, wow, we're so quirky. So for me, I always go, okay, so what is the quirkiness I can find for us over here? And I put a lens on it, and then that's what we kind of play with as material.
And you do that not just brilliantly, but you have a great deal of fun. And if we look back to what could have been Stuart the serial cow seducer or Stuart the number cruncher, possibly in Uppington, where it sounds like you would have been quite happy.
Absolutely.
But I might not be a terribly religious person, but I have a reasonable belief in fate and that we kind of get to where we should be one way or another.
Yes.
And I think if Stuart Taylor were to look back, if you combine the career, the family, the fabulous wife, the life that you've led and are leading, it's gone pretty well for Stuart Taylor.
Yeah, no, listen, I cannot complain. It's it really is. I'm very lucky. I'm very blessed. I live in an amazing space, and I get to do the things that I love to do, and I get to have amazing experiences. And not a day goes by when I don't count my blessings. It really is. As I say, that thing of if you just turned a different corner, if I just didn't go to KC on that day with my mom and watch that magician perform, would I have fallen in love with magic and would I have found the College of Magic and would I have gone to Stellenbosch and would I have met my wife and would I have gotten all of these things? It really is the stars aligning, and I'm acutely aware of how lucky I am and how blessed I am. And yeah. I get to hang out with people like Dan Nicol. What a pleasure.
And if you'd paid for that meal at McDonald's, maybe should have thought, ha, this guy is crazy with his money.
Yes.
He's not the one for me.
Absolutely.
And life could have been very different. I mentioned at the very start that you were part of how I end up in television. Just to finish off, for those people who aren't aware, we did tell this story a number of times on the Dan Nicol Show and we were running on Supersport over the years. But we attempted to create the show back
yes.
in 2002, 2003 mm-hmm. With your very close friend Emily Whitefield and
yes,
mine.
My bestie.
And Rick Salizzo.
Your bestie.
The New
Our
Zealand
bestie.
Television god. And I'm very glad it didn't happen when it did, because I think it might have been maybe not quite as much of a car crash as the show that replaced it became. But I don't think we would have got the best out of it. But in the end...
We were so annoyed. We were so... The thing of you end up where you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
I remember I was in Mossel Bay. I was in Mossel Bay on Going Nowhere Slowly watching the show that our show became.
Without us in it.
Without us in it. Screaming at the television with anger. And I probably called you and we would have chatted.
I think we sent each other a please call
yes.
me, but neither of us had any money.
And just being so annoyed by what we wanted to do and then what they did with it. But that incubation period.
Oh, yeah.
Allowed for you to then go and do the Dan Nicol yeah. show in how many more? I mean, I don't, you had how many seasons?
16 seasons.
I don't think they had 16 episodes. They might have had six.
Like each one felt like 16 hours, but let us not be petty because it has worked out. The fates have directed it as they did, me being in a theatre in Rondebosch 20 odd years ago when this slightly gawky looking comedian came out, and that was when I first fell in love with Stuart Taylor.
Oh,
and it's been a wonderful romance jacket. Since
it has, and thanks Dan, you know, I say I've had some of the best experiences on this planet thanks to you. You've opened my eyes. I drink wine now, Dan, and that is thanks to you, not my wife. She will take some of the credit, but it is honestly you. No, I mean, I've gotten to do some of the most amazing things because we've gone on many, many adventures together, and it's always interesting. It's always fun. It's always great company. And so thanks for showing me that there's more than just the Gatsby
and a Spice
Golden Coke.
Take a different place. Probably the best thing of all of that, though, is that as much fun as we've had together, the adventures are not done. I'm not sure what the next ones will be. They will quite possibly involve police and other such misadventure.
Five-star hotels and police, my favorite combo.
Stuart, it's been an absolute pleasure, as always. Thanks for everything you've given me over the years, and let more adventures unfold.
Absolutely. Thanks for your time, Dan.
You're listening. listening to The Dan Nichols Show.